Patrol took a look at the scene, and a Russian soldier made a bolt for the stairs at the sight of them, moving with bent, averted head, like a small harvest animal. The Americans never stirred, and nobody interfered with them. Martin's had drink after drink. He would probably have had a woman, too, but the cabaret performers had all gone home, and there were practically no women left in the place, except for one beautiful, shrewd-looking French journalist who made one remark to her companion and fell contemptuously asleep. Martin's moved on. At Maxim's, a few couples were dancing rather gloomily, and at a place called Chez Victor, the heating had failed, and people sat in overcoats drinking cocktails. By this time the spots were swimming in front of Martin's eyes, and he was oppressed by a sense of loneliness. His mind reverted to the girl in Dublin and the one in Amsterdam. That was one thing that didn't fool you, the straight drink, the simple physical act. One didn't expect fidelity from a woman. His mind revolved in circles, from sentiment to lust and back again, from belief to cynicism. The trams had stopped, and he set out obstinately on foot to find Harry's girl. He wanted to make love to her, just like that, no nonsense, no sentiment. He was in the mood for violence, and the snowy road heaved like a lake and set his mind on a new course towards sorrow, eternal love, renunciation. In the corner of a sheltering wall he was sick in the snow. It must have been about 3 in the morning when he climbed the stairs to Anna's room. He was nearly sober by that time, and had only one idea in his head, that she must know about Harry, too. He felt that somehow this knowledge would pay the mortmain that memory levies on human beings, and he would stand a chance with Harry's girl. If you're in love yourself, it never occurs to you that the girl doesn't know. You believe you have told it plainly, in a tone of voice, the touch of a hand. When Anna opened the door to him, with astonishment at the sight of him tousled on the threshold, he never imagined that she was opening the door to a stranger. He said, "Anna, I've found out everything." "Come in," she said. "You don't want to wake the house." She was in a dressing gown. The divan had become a bed, the kind of tumbled bed that showed how sleepless the occupant had been. "Now," she said, while he stood there fumbling for words, "what is it? I thought you were going to keep away. Are the police after you?" "No." "You didn't really kill that man, did you?"
"Of course not."
"You're drunk, aren't you?"
"I am a bit," he said sulkily. The meeting seemed to be going on the wrong lines. He said angrily, "I'm sorry."
"Why? I would like a drink myself."
He said, "I've been with the British police. They are satisfied I didn't do it. But I've learned everything from them. Harry was in a racket, a bad racket." He said, hopelessly, "He was no good at all. We were both wrong."
"You'd better tell me,"
Anna said. She sat down on the bed, and he told her, swaying slightly beside the table where her typescript part still lay open at the first page. I imagine he told it to her pretty confusedly, dwelling chiefly on what had stuck most in his mind, the children dead with meningitis, and the children in the mental ward. He stopped, and they were silent. She said,
"Is that all?"
"Yes."
"You were sober when they told you? They really proved it?"
"Yes." He added drearily, "So that, you see, was Harry."
"I'm glad he's dead now," she said.
"I wouldn't have wanted him to rot for years in prison."
"But can you understand how Harry, your Harry, my Harry, could have got mixed up?"
He said hopelessly,
"I feel as though he had never really existed, that we dreamed him. Was he laughing at fools like us all the time?"
"He may have been. What does it matter?" she said.
"Sit down. Don't worry."
He had pictured himself comforting her, not this other way about. She said,
"If he was alive now, he might be able to explain. But we've got to remember him as he was to us. There are always so many things one doesn't know about a person, even a person one loves. Good things, bad things. We have to leave plenty of room for them."
"Those children," she said angrily,
"for God's sake, stop making people in your image. Harry was real.
He wasn't just your hero and my lover. He was Harry. He was in a racket. He did bad things. What about it? He was the man we knew.
He said, "Don't talk such bloody wisdom. Don't you see that I love you?" She looked at him in astonishment.
"You?"
"Yes, me. I don't kill people with fake drugs. I'm not a hypocrite who persuades people that I'm the greatest. I'm just a bad writer who drinks too much and falls in love with girls." She said, "But I don't even know what color your eyes are. If you'd rung me up just now and asked me whether you were dark or fair or wore a moustache, I wouldn't have known. Can't you get him out of your mind?"
"No."
He said, "As soon as they've cleared up this Koch murder, I'm leaving Vienna. I can't feel interested any longer in whether Kurtz killed Harry or the third man. Whoever killed him, it was a kind of justice. Maybe I'd kill him myself under these circumstances. But you still love him. You love a cheat, a murderer."
"I loved a man," she said. "I told you, a man doesn't alter because you find out more about him. He's still the same man."
"I hate the way you talk. I've got a splitting headache, and you talk and talk."
"I didn't ask you to come."
"You make me cross." Suddenly she laughed. She said,
"You are so comic. You come here at 3 in the morning, a stranger, and say you love me. Then you get angry and pick a quarrel. What do you expect me to do or say?"
"I haven't seen you laugh before. Do it again. I like it."
"There isn't enough for 2 laughs, she said.
He took her by the shoulders and shook her gently. He said, "I'd make comic faces all day long. I'd stand on my head and grin at you between my legs. I'd learn a lot of jokes from the books on after-dinner speaking."
"Come away from the window. There are no curtains."
"There's nobody to see."
But automatically checking his statement, he wasn't quite so sure. A long shadow that had moved, perhaps with the movement of clouds over the moon, was motionless again.
He said, "You still love Harry, don't you?"
"Yes."
"Perhaps I do. I don't know." He dropped his hands and said, "I'll be pushing off." He walked rapidly away. He didn't bother to see whether he was being followed, to check up on the shadow. But passing by the end of a street, he happened to turn, and there, just around the corner, pressed against a wall to escape notice, was a thick, stocky figure. Martin stopped and stared. There was something familiar about that figure. Perhaps, he thought, I've grown unconsciously used to him during these last 24 hours. Perhaps he's one of those who have so assiduously checked my movements. Martin stood there, 20 yards away, staring at the silent, motionless figure in the dark street who stared back at him. A police spy, perhaps, or an agent of those other men, those men who had corrupted Harry first and then killed him. Even possibly the third man. It was not the face that was familiar, for he could not make out so much as the angle of the jaw, nor a movement, for the body was so still that he began to believe that the whole thing was an illusion caused by a shadow. He called sharply, "Do you want anything?" And there was no reply. He called again with the irascibility of drink, "Answer, can't you?" And an answer came, for a window curtain was drawn petulantly back by some sleeper he had awakened, and the light fell straight across the narrow street and lit up the features of Harry Lime. "Do you believe in ghosts?" Martin said to me.
"Do you?"
"I do now."
"I also believe that drunk men see things, sometimes rats, sometimes worse." He hadn't come to me at once with his story. Only the danger to Anna Schmidt tossed him back into my office, like something the sea had washed up, tousled, unshaven, haunted by an experience he couldn't understand. He said, "If it had been just the face, I wouldn't have worried. I'd been thinking about Harry, and I might easily have mistaken a stranger. The light was turned off again at once, you see. I only got 1 glimpse, and the man made off down the street, if he was a man. There was no turning for a long way, but I was so startled I gave him another 30 yards start. He came to one of those advertisement kiosks, and for a moment moved out of my sight. I ran after him. It only took me 10 seconds to reach the kiosk, and he must have heard me running, but the strange thing was he never appeared again.
I reached the kiosk. There wasn't anybody there. The street was empty. He couldn't have reached a doorway without my seeing him. He simply vanished. A natural thing for ghosts, or illusions. But I can't believe I was as drunk as all that.
What did you do then?
I had to have another drink. My nerves were all in pieces.
Didn't that bring him back?
No, but it sent me back to Anna's.
I think he would have been ashamed to come to me with his absurd story if it had not been for the attempt on Anna Schmidt. My theory when he did tell me his story was that there had been a watcher, though it was drink and hysteria that had pasted on the man's face the features of Harry Lime. The watcher had noted his visit to Anna, and the member of the ring, the penicillin ring, had been warned by telephone. Events that night moved fast. You remember that Kurtz lived in the Russian zone, in the second Bezirk, to be exact, in a wide, empty, desolate street that runs down to the Praterplatz. A man like that had probably obtained his influential contacts. It was ruin for a Russian to be observed on very friendly terms with an American or an Englishman, but the Austrian was a potential ally, and in any case one doesn't fear the influence of the ruined and defeated. You must understand that at this period cooperation between the Western Allies and the Russians had practically, though not yet completely, broken down. The original police agreement in Vienna between the Allies confined the military police, who had to deal with crimes involving Allied personnel, to their particular zones, unless permission was given to them to enter the zone of another power. This agreement worked well enough between the three Western powers. I only had to get on the phone to my opposite number in the American or French zones before I sent in my men to make an arrest or pursue an investigation. During the first 6 months of the occupation, it had worked reasonably well with the Russians. Perhaps 48 hours would pass before I received permission, and in practice there are few occasions when it is necessary to work quicker than that. Even at home it is not always possible to obtain a search warrant or permission from one's superiors to detain a suspect with any greater speed. Then the 48 hours turned into a week or a fortnight, and I remember my American colleague suddenly taking a look at his records and discovering that there were 40 cases dating back more than 3 months where not even an acknowledgement of his requests had been received. Then the trouble started. We began to turn down or not to answer the Russian requests, and sometimes without permission they would send in police, and there were clashes. At the date of this story, the Western powers had more or less ceased to put in applications or reply to the Russian ones. This meant that if I wanted to pick up Kurtz, it would be as well to catch him outside the Russian zone. Though, of course, it was always possible his activities might offend the Russians, and his punishment be more sudden and severe than any we should inflict. Well, the Anna Schmidt case was one of the clashes. When Rollo Martins went drunkenly back at 4 o'clock in the morning to tell Anna that he had seen the ghost of Harry, he was told by a frightened porter who had not yet gone back to sleep that she had been taken away by the international patrol. What happened was this. Russia, you remember, was in the chair as far as the Innerstadt was concerned, and when Russia was in the chair, you expected certain irregularities. On this occasion, halfway through the patrol, the Russian policeman pulled a fast one on his colleagues and directed the car to the street where Anna Schmidt lived. The British military policeman that night was new to his job. He didn't realize till his colleagues told him that they had entered a British zone. He spoke a little German and no French, and the Frenchman, a cynical, hard-bitten Parisian, gave up the attempt to explain to him. The American took on the job. "It's all right by me," he said, "but is it all right by you?" The British military policeman tapped the Russian's shoulder, who turned his Mongol face and launched a flood of incomprehensible Slav at him. The car drove on. Outside Anna Schmidt's block, the American took a hand in the game and demanded in German what it was all about. The Frenchman leaned against the bonnet and lit a stinking caporal. France wasn't concerned, and anything that didn't concern France had no genuine importance to him. The Russian dug out a few words of German and flourished some papers. As far as they could tell, a Russian national wanted by the Russian police was living there without proper papers. They went upstairs, and the Russian tried Anna's door. It was firmly bolted, but he put his shoulder to it and tore out the bolt without giving the occupant an opportunity of letting him in. Anna was in bed, though I don't suppose after Martin's visit that she was asleep. There is a lot of comedy in these situations if you are not directly concerned.
You need a background of Central European terror, of a father who belonged to a losing side, of house searches and disappearances, before the fear outweighs the comedy. The Russian, you see, refused to leave the room while Anna dressed. The Englishman refused to remain in the room. The American wouldn't leave a girl unprotected with a Russian soldier. And the Frenchman, well, I think the Frenchman must have thought it was fun. Can't you imagine the scene? The Russian was just doing his duty and watched the girl all the time, without a flicker of sexual interest. The American stood with his back chivalrously turned, but aware, I'm sure, of every movement. The Frenchman smoked his cigarette and watched with detached amusement the reflection of the girl dressing in the mirror of the wardrobe. And the Englishman stood in the passage wondering what to do next. I don't want you to think the English policeman came too badly out of the affair. In the passage, undistracted by chivalry, he had time to think, and his thoughts led him to the telephone in the next flat. He got straight through to me at my flat and woke me out of that deepest middle sleep. That was why, when Martins rang up an hour later, I already knew what was exciting him. It gave him an undeserved but very useful belief in my efficiency. I never heard another crack from him about policemen or sheriffs after that night. I must explain another point of police procedure. If the International Patrol made an arrest, they had to lodge their prisoner for 24 hours at the International Headquarters. During that period, it would be determined which power could justifiably claim the prisoner. It was this rule that the Russians were most ready to break. Because so few of us can speak Russian, and the Russian is almost debarred from explaining his point of view, try and explain your own point of view on any subject in a language you don't know well. It's not as easy as ordering a meal. We are apt to regard any breach of an agreement by the Russians as deliberate and malign. I think it quite possible that they understood this agreement as referring only to prisoners about whom there was a dispute. It's true that there was a dispute about nearly every prisoner they took, but there was no dispute in their own minds, and no one has a greater sense of self-righteousness than a Russian. Even in his confessions, a Russian is self-righteous. He pours out his revelations, but he doesn't excuse himself. He needs no excuse. All this had to form the background of one's decision. I gave my instructions to Corporal Starling. When he came back to Anna's room, a dispute was raging. Anna had told the American that she had Austrian papers, which was true, and that they were quite in order, which was rather stretching the truth. The American told the Russian, in bad German, that they had no right to arrest an Austrian citizen. He asked Anna for her papers, and when she produced them, the Russian snatched them from her hand. "Hungarian," he said, pointing at Anna. "Hungarian." And then, flourishing the papers, "Bed. Bed." The American, whose name was O'Brien, said, "Give the girl back her papers," which the Russian naturally didn't understand. The American put his hand on his gun, and Corporal Starling said gently, "Let it go, Pat. If those papers ain't in order, we got a right to look. Just let it go. We'll see the papers at HQ. If we get to HQ, you can't trust these Russian drivers. As like as not, he'll drive straight through to his zone." "We'll see," Starling said. "The trouble about you British is you never know when to make a stand." "Oh, well," Starling said. He had been at Dunkirk, but he knew when to be quiet. They got back into the car with Anna, who sat in the front between the two Russians, dumb with fear. After they had gone a little way, the American touched the Russian on the shoulder. "Wrong way," he said. "HQ that way." The Russian chattered back in his own tongue, making a conciliatory gesture while they drove on. "It's what I said," O'Brien told Starling. "They're taking her to the Russian zone." Anna stared out with terror through the windscreen. "Don't worry, little girl," O'Brien said. "I'll fix him all right." His hand was fidgeting round his gun again. Starling said, "Look here, Pat, this is a British case. You don't have to get involved. You are new to this game. You don't know these bastards. It's not worth making an incident about." "For Christ's sake," O'Brien said. "Not worth? That little girl's gotta have protection." American chivalry is always, it seems to me, carefully canalized. One still awaits the American saint who will kiss a leper's sores. The driver put on his brakes suddenly. There was a roadblock. You see, I knew they would have to pass this military post if they did not make their way to International HQ in the inner city. I put my head in at the window and said to the Russian, haltingly,